A very, very warm welcome to the Plan 2050 lectures. We're very proud to host these lectures here, and tonight is our first. This is a partnership between the Diocese of Sheffield, Sheffield Campaign Against Climate Change, and Sheffield Cathedral. And you'll have seen from our publicity that we have three eminent speakers lined up who are going to introduce us to this topic, the politics of the future. Before I hand over to the person who's going to introduce Alison, just a few bits of housekeeping. You'll find our facilities through the archway over there and then through the gallery, and our hospitality assistants are there if you need any further direction. After Alison's spoken, there will be refreshments in the gallery and then a chance to come back again for the discussion. And there are lots of nibbles and pleasant things out there. Exits are over there, which is a level exit if you don't want to go up the stairs, and then the way that most of you have come in, where the tickets were being sold. In the case of any kind of emergency, please follow our verger or our stewards, and they'll point you in the right direction. I hope you have a very enjoyable evening, and I look forward to seeing you for the rest of the series of lectures. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Heather Hunt from Sheffield Campaign Against Climate Change, and it's our great pleasure to be jointly hosting this series of lectures, and my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Dr. Alison Cook, who is the chair of the Institute of Mechanical Engineers Future Climate Project, and that's what Alison will be mostly talking to us about tonight. A little bit about Alison. After graduating as a mechanical engineer, she worked for BP for 2 years and then decided this was not for her, and taught at Cambridge for many years and managed many public and private projects. In 97, she started Cook Associates, and then recently has been very active in the Institute of Mechanical Engineers. And chairing this Future Climate Project, as she said, is taking over her life. And just so that we know, this is all voluntary work and shows, like many people here, this commitment to use our own talents and skills to do our very best in this climate crisis. So before I hand over to Alison, just to let you know about the course of the evening. Alison will speak for about 40, 45 minutes. We'll then have a refreshment break, which will be at the back of the room. You can bring your refreshments back here, but we'll have about a quarter of an hour break, and then 20 minutes or so of questions and discussion. And then at the very end, Michael Bailey here will just say a bit more about the 2050 project. So now it's my very great pleasure to hand over to Alison Cook to tell us about the Future Climate Project. Thank you, Alison.
Well, thank you, Heather. And thank you to all of you. Congratulations for making it through the drizzle to come to this lovely cathedral tonight. I don't know how many engineers we have in here. How many engineers do we have in the house? Oh, a few. So some of you might have heard of the Institution of Mechanical Engineers. Anyone heard of the Institution of Mechanical Engineers? Good? Oh, good. That's good for us. More about that later. So here we all are, Sheffield Cathedral. And what a beautiful place it is, too. It's lovely to be here. And these places are very majestic. And they always remind me what an amazing engineering feat it must have been to have created and built something like this. And I'm sure when, I think in 1914, they were telling me earlier, they were planning to take the whole axis of the cathedral and turn it 90 degrees into another direction. And I'm sure when architects come up with those sorts of ideas, they say, you know, no way. But often things like that can be achieved from an engineering perspective. And I expect, is the Sheffield Cathedral the Church of St. Paul and St. Peter's as well? Is that correct? And I expect when St. Peter and St. Paul, if someone had told them, on this rock will be built a church which will be going 2,000 years later, I imagine they would have gone, no way, what, me? Just one little me? There's no way that's going to happen. So I stand here today as an engineer where we can say, like all of you, there are huge challenges ahead of us in terms of climate change. But I stand here as an engineer saying, I think we can achieve the challenge. We can overcome the challenge. And I hope by the end of the evening, you'll be able to agree with me. I was having a look at the Sheffield Cathedral website. I'm blocking some people here, so I think I'll go mobile. Is that working? Oh, it is. Okay. I was having a look at the Sheffield Cathedral website, and I thought I'd share this with you, partly to show that I'm an engineer, but I'm not completely unpoetic. And this Philip Larkin's church-going poem is on there. I don't know, has anyone ever read it? Yeah, and I thought it sort of summed up a little bit of what I was going to be trying to share with you tonight. It pleases me to stand in silence here. A serious house on serious earth it is, in whose blent air all our compulsions meet, are recognised and robed as destinies. So I don't know where you're coming from. I know where I'm coming from. I don't know where you're coming from. I don't know what's brought you here, what's compelled you to come here. But I think there is something in that last line which actually rings true with me, in that we're on the brink, engineering-wise, of a third industrial revolution. That's what all the engineers agree. And so there is something quite sort of challenging about that poem, and I thought I would share it with you. So, a serious house on serious earth it is. So we're talking about serious subjects, and it's about our destiny. But I don't suppose you'll want me to stand in silence for 40 minutes, so I'll keep going if that's all right. Okay, so as I said, this is the Future Climate Project. You might very well say, what is that? I will come on to that about halfway through the talk. I'll talk to you a little bit more about what the Future Climate Project entails. The Institution of Mechanical Engineers is one of three big engineering institutions in the country, representing, we have about 80,000 members, mechanical engineers, at all levels of their career. So we have students who are at university studying mechanical engineering through to fellows who have actually graduated, they've had at least 4 years on-the-job training, they've then developed and managed people and developed a bank of expert knowledge, and then they're peer-reviewed by their peers at the institution, and if they pass that peer review, then they're made fellows. And I believe one of my colleagues told me the average age of a fellow in the Institution of Mechanical Engineers is 63. So you're speaking to a rather young one tonight, or I'm speaking to you. David Mackay, hands up who's heard of David Mackay? He's a very good man. He was on our Future Climate Project team, which we put together earlier this year. And hands up who's read the great book? Okay. If you haven't read it, I really do recommend, if you're interested in this field at all, then it's a really good book to start with. And he's a professor of physics. I know it says natural philosophy, but that's the way Cambridge works, I'm afraid. Natural philosophy was in Aristotelian days, you know, where physics was natural philosophy. Okay, physics was the basis of natural philosophy. So, as is the way with professors of natural philosophy at Cambridge, one of the things, you know, the great names you may have heard, Cavendish, Faraday, you know, that they were said, okay, you have a chair at Cambridge University Physics Laboratory, what's the big issue of the day? Go away and research it. And there are independent folk who actually could go away and take the big issues of the day and actually do some work on it, which is, in essence, exactly what David has done, because his expertise, in the same way that my expertise, is not climate change. You know, I know Heather mentioned earlier, I worked at BP, I worked for an energy company for a couple of years, but since then, I've not been working in an energy company, I've not been working in climate change, I've been working in a different field, in sports engineering and the design of sports equipment, and teaching at Cambridge. So, like David, his main research area was neural networks, which is about how neural, you know, the networks of the brain and the networks of computers and how that all
very, very sort of very erudite, I think erudite work. If you go into it, it's quite a lot of software and hard to get to grips with. But he came to this because he realised, as someone who cared, that there was a lot of hot air. You've come across the book that I've just held up. If you've read it, Sustainable Energy Without the Hot Air. Because he was listening to politicians and people on the news and, you know, hearing this debate, and he was saying, well, where are the numbers? So he basically, as a physics professor at Cambridge, decided, I'll go away and do the numbers. And the Future Climate Project team, which was formed this year to actually address some of the international and national challenges that we have as engineers for how we're going to achieve some of the targets that have been set in Kyoto and by our government, he joined our project team as an external expert. So as a fellow, he's a fellow of the Royal Society and has just this summer been appointed by Ed Miliband to work for the Department for Energy and Climate Change. So if to start with, because I didn't know what backgrounds you were coming from, you know, what compelled you to be here as we were reading that poem earlier, I thought I would start with the basics of what is the whole issue of climate change, what is a greenhouse effect, and I'll flick through those just in case anyone needs clarification, and then I'll talk about his numbers for a while, because I think it's really important to actually get a real handle personally on what our energy demands are and what our energy supply is and might be. And then the second half of the talk, I'll go on to talking about the Future Climate Project in essence. And one of the main outcome of the Future Climate Project was for the IMEC-E to come up with a consensus plan for how we will achieve the 2050 greenhouse gas reduction targets in the UK. Okay, and then we shared that with lots of other engineers from countries all over the world last month in Copenhagen. Okay. So that was our big outcome. So first of all, motivations, you know, which if you've read the book will be covered in chapter one of David Mackay's book. Can Britain live on renewables? You know, we hear a lot of different discussions about, we could have all wind, or we need to improve our tidal energy supply. We don't need nuclear. We hear all of these things. And he actually addressed this in the book. Can Britain actually live on renewable energy alone? So I'll take us through that chapter, chapter 18. And then in chapter 27, what he does is he actually says, okay, well, we know what I've taken you through our personal demand. I've taken you through some of the supply issues that we have. What does the future look like? And he presents scenarios. And he has five key scenarios he talks about. Now, I was at a meeting in London last week. Again, David was there. Department for Energy and Climate Change representatives were there. Her Majesty's Treasury were there. Some of the energy companies were there. And it was a very highly motivated workshop to discuss the next steps. In other words, when are the technologies going to have to be introduced? In what year? And how much is it going to cost us? And that was a meeting last Monday, the 28th of September, we were talking about that. And a lot of the organisations there were other organisations as well as the Institution of Mechanical Engineers. There's the first people from the first Committee on Climate Change. There's been a report brought out by the Committee on Climate Change. There's been reports brought out by DEC itself, Department for Energy and Climate Change, which I'll call DEC for ease from now on. There's also the ERP, the Energy Research Partnership. There's lots of different reports have been produced over the last year. And they're all presenting different scenarios. And the Royal Academy of Engineering is presenting different scenarios and saying, well, it's up to government to choose. But one of our tasks for the Institution of Mechanical Engineers was we were tasked with coming up with one. So we were asked to actually put our stamp on one and say, well, this is the one we would go with. And I'll come on to why we were asked to do that later. So UK scenarios, that's the way a lot of organisations are working. They're saying, well, we can say here's one without nuclear, one which is all without wind, here's one which imports energy from abroad, here's et cetera, et cetera. And so there's a lot of scenarios out there at the moment. And it's government's job to try and discern, well, so that's what some people think, it's government's job to try and discern which is the best way forward and which scenario is best to choose. So as I said, come on to Future Climate Project. The team that we put that I put together actually to actually address that project, and then I'll present the actual energy plan we came up with at the end. Okay. Now, as David Mackay says in his book, we're academics. We're used to peer reviewing our work. You know, we can. He wrote a book, and I think if you've read it, you'll know at the beginning of his book he says, "Here are my numbers. They might be wrong. Tell me if they are." You know, but there is nothing else written. So that's the way we academics work. So when I was at Cambridge, you publish your papers, you do some research, you publish your papers, you have people review it. If they like what they say, they'll agree with it. If they don't, they'll publish something that says, well, that was a load of tosh. You know, so that's the way it works. And we are very conscious at the IMECE that we produce one energy plan after 1 year. And again, you know, it's up for debate. And we're very conscious that things are changing all the time. So I wouldn't like to be in government and having to make these decisions, I have to say, because it's very complex, and you'll see how complex it is. Okay, so coming on to motivations. Well, some people have motivations of saving the planet. Some people may not worry about that at all. Some people might say, actually, we as Britain, we don't want to rely on foreign countries for our security of our supply, so we want to make sure that we are independent from other countries. Some people's motivations might be purely financial. But I thought I'd go back to the basics of the science. So forgive me if this is like teaching grandmother to suck eggs, but I didn't know whether people would be walking in off the street and not understanding, you know, the basics of it. So what are we talking about when we're talking about the greenhouse effect? Well, as you see, we get our renewable energy, which I always think that's interesting, because is the sun renewable? Probably not. It's actually just alternative energy, really. But we call them renewable energy sources, but ultimately the sun is dying, so you could argue that's a misnomer in itself. So the energy comes down, the radiation comes down from the sun, hits the earth, some is the yellow there, some is absorbed, some is radiated outwards, and is trapped by the clouds. Now, I have a good debate with my teenage daughter, and she's got a climate change skeptic in her class, and he says, yes, but it's the water vapour is creating all the problem. It's, you know, there's clouds, there's water vapour in the air all the time. It's nothing to do with carbon dioxide. And in a sense, he's right, is that there has always been a blanket around the earth, which has been our clouds. And so it traps the radiation in, and you get this greenhouse effect, i.e. the earth warms up. Some of it is dissipated through the clouds, but some of it stays inside. But I think this next slide will show that the clouds have always been there. The water cycle, you know, it's always been raining, going into the sea, you know, evaporating, going back up into the clouds forever and a day since humans have been on the earth. But if you look at this graph, on the vertical axis is the parts per million carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere, and we start in year 1000 there on the left on the horizontal axis, and we go up to year 2000, and you'll see that when the steam engine was invented, that's James Watt, 1769, you'll see what happens to the carbon dioxide concentration, and it doesn't take a rocket scientist to think, well, actually, that might have some long-term effect on what's happening on the Earth. So basically, all that carbon dioxide was fairly stable, 280 parts per million, until the second Industrial Revolution or First Industrial Revolution. In Copenhagen, we had this good debate. Anyone heard of Jeremy Rifkin? Jeremy Rifkin, he was our keynote speaker at in the engineering conference in Copenhagen in early September. And he was arguing that actually the steam engine was the second industrial revolution, because when the printing press started, we had a revolution, because people started communicating through the written word. Okay, and when we had the second industrial revolution, he said, we started communicating because we could move around. And he was arguing that with this third industrial revolution, which is our response to climate change, we've got a great opportunity because never before have we seen, like what we saw last week, all the world leaders coming together and starting to communicate in a global political arena. And so it's a really quite an interesting philosophical debate. It's that, you know, your printing press, people started communicating with the written word. Steam engine, people started communicating because they could get around. Climate change, people start communicating on a global political level. And then you've got the internet, you know, which is a whole new world compared to the written word and on papyrus or, you know, on paper. You've got the whole opportunity to communicate through the internet and through email. So it's his argument was Industrial Revolution, whole new mode of communication. Steam engine, whole new mode of communication. Climate change, whole new a revolution in the way we actually communicate around the world, potentially. That was the argument. So basically, steam engine, huge amounts of fossil fuel, carbon dioxide from fossil fuel being released into the atmosphere. And for those people who don't still want to believe that that might have an effect, this slide, I should say at this point, and particularly when this might be going on the website, David has shared a lot of his figures with me. If I haven't titled them with someone else's, cited someone else, then they are David's slides. The second half of the talk will be purely the Future Climate Team slides. But the previous one, so therefore the previous one was David Mackay's slide from his book. This one was from the conference in early September. So, as I said, international groups of engineers coming together. It's very exciting to see people coming together and actually agreeing on quite a lot of major issues. And engineers tend, on the whole, I've found in my career, they tend to be quite conservative with a small c. You know, don't tend to get very excited and emotional about things. But there was quite a lot of excitement and passion over in Copenhagen in this conference. So this was from the director of CICERO, the Centre for International Climate Environmental Research in Norway, in Oslo. And he had this interesting slide. It just follows on nicely from David. So if you excuse the Norwegian spelling of concentration, concentration with an S, if you have increasing concentration, the top graph, increasing concentration of carbon dioxide, okay, that I'm sorry at the back, you won't read it. I'm used to presenting this in small rooms, not cathedrals. So you've got 19, at the bottom there, you're going from about 1975, okay, similar to the previous slide, up to 2007, something like that. And you've got parts per million of carbon dioxide on the vertical axis, going from about 330 at the top there to 380. So you've got increasing ppm on carbon dioxide, and those are actual measurements. Okay, so they're not predictions or models or computer models, they're actual measurements. And you'll see the sort of fluctuation, which is due to the seasonal variation, you know, as you go year on year.
Yeah. On the top graph.
Yeah, top graph. Yeah, but those principles will follow as we go down. So the top graph is carbon dioxide ppm parts per million. Okay, concentration of, and you'll see there's let me wave the cursor around a bit. You might not see this right at the back, but there's a seasonal variation. So there's measurements which are going. The big blue line is the average. Annual average, and then you've got the sort of fluctuations, which is a seasonal variation. Similarly, on the second one down, that's the temperature change. So again, these are actual figures. You'll see again the seasonal temperature change that you would expect with the seasons in Norway, and you've got a temperature increase there from, you know, 1970-ish to 2005, which is about 0.5, 0.6 of a degree C. Okay. Half a degree C. Then on the third graph down, you've got increasing sea level. Okay, so again, the same time lapse, 1970s to 2005, and you've got centimetres of change. Okay, so you've got about 5 centimetre change. Okay, so those are actual figures. When you see the graphs splay out on the far right, those are models, those are predictions. Usually best, going back to what we were saying about scenarios, they're usually best and worst case scenarios. So has anyone heard of the International Panel of Climate Change? Again, I'd recommend you going on their website. They've got some really easy to understand, really good science on there, which is accessible to everyone. And they are doing these sorts of models all the time to see what the best and worst case scenarios would be for us. So I would recommend going on their website. And I think I have the next slide is... It's not from. I have a slide later on from IPCC, the International Panel of Climate Change, as opposed to the Independent Police Complaints Commission.
Is that the Millennium Scenarios?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Millennium scenarios.
Yeah, they have blue. There are all sorts of different names for them. So they have blue scenarios. They red. The International Energy Agency has blue. The blue scenario, the red scenario. So that people are working on scenarios all the time because it's hard to actually pick one definitive situation. So this again was from Cicero. If we were to see, so the bottom axis, the horizontal axis is temperature rise. So we saw from the last slides that we were seeing about half a degree since 1970-ish. We've seen half a degree. These predictions are, if we go, you've heard of the 2-degree limit that actually the International Panel on Climate Change is saying we want to really limit our climate change right up our temperature rise to 2 degrees, and this is why. Okay, so the potential damages of the vertical axis dealing with risk of coastal flooding, well, that's the one that everyone thinks about because they think increase in sea level, coastal flooding, people lose their homes. But he was saying, you know, it's much more than that, and the biggest danger we have is the water shortage that we're going to get. And the vertical axis is how many people are going to be at risk health-wise or even at risk fatally. And so we've got risk of coastal flooding might create some health issues and some fatalities, but by far the worst one is the water shortage that we're going to get if we have those temperature over 2-degree temperature rise. The yellow one, so that's the blue one, for those at the back who can't read it, the blue one, the worst risk is going to be because of water shortage if we get those sorts of temperature rises. The yellow one is risk of malaria, because when you start having the coastal flooding, you start getting the mosquitoes, you start getting an increase in problems with malaria. And risk of hunger, of course, because of people being displaced, because of famine, because of drought. So again, that's the red one. Okay, this graph is, it's a red and a blue line. The vertical axis is tons of carbon dioxide per year per person. So now we're getting down to the individual. And because I knew I was going to stand up in front of you all tonight, my husband and I were doing the latest carbon footprint for our household. So I'll tell you about that later. We've been doing that for 2 years, but I thought I'd better update it. But this gives us an idea of what our personal challenges and what are therefore our political and global challenges. So it's tons of carbon dioxide per year per person on the left, and it goes from 0 to 6. And on the horizontal axis is 2000 to 2100, so this next 100 years. If we hit the red one, i.e. we get to a world average of 6 tons, we're talking about a world average here, of 6 tons of carbon dioxide per year per person, okay, then we have a 9 to 26% chance of still going greater than a 2-degree rise. That's everything under that red line, okay? If we can follow that red line and we can get down to under 1 ton of carbon dioxide by 2050, okay, we still have a 9 to 26% chance of a 2-degree temperature rise. Does that make sense to everyone? So everything under the graph. If we only hit the blue one, and you'll see the tiny difference between the red and the blue. So if we're a little bit late in reducing our world average tons per person per year, then we hit the blue one, then there's a 16 to 43% chance that we will have a greater than 2-degree temperature rise. So we start to see the urgency of acting very, very quickly on all of these, pushing forward on all of these technologies or all of these initiatives and policies and moving fast. Because if we don't move fast, the percentage, the probability of going above 2 degrees is higher. And what do if you follow this carefully, and a lot of people here, I'm sure, follow this very carefully, the IPCC and the climate scientists are saying that actually currently the world average is between 5 and 6 tonnes of carbon dioxide per year per person. That's the world average, developed and developing countries. So if we take all the population and all the carbon tonnage of carbon dioxide produced in the world and we divide it by the global population, we get between 5 and 6 tonnes of carbon dioxide. What they're saying we need to get down to by 2050 is 1 tonne world average. And then you start talking about zero carbon, you know, a zero carbon society almost, because if you're aiming for that low a tonnage of carbon dioxide per year per person, then you might as well be aiming for a zero carbon. Okay, well, that's fine. My husband and I did it last week, so to come clean, we are currently, as a household of 4, using the Carbon Trust footprints, carbon footprint website. Has anyone used that one, the Carbon Trust website? It's very easy to work through. It doesn't have all the ways in which we produce carbon, all the indirect ways, I guess, but it has a lot of the indirect ways, secondary ways. And so we're existing on, with that website, we're at the moment running at about 19 tonnes per year in our household. So with 4 of us, I was quite amazed because we're actually at the world average. Okay, but as I said, that doesn't, you'll see when I come on to some later slides, there's all sorts of indirect things that we cannot measure. They're not easy to measure, but David does have a go at measuring them in his book. But it doesn't mean to say we're going to sit back and relax, but it does give you a measure. And so I would recommend you going on that website or some of the other websites and actually starting to measure carbon footprint. Okay, that's me and my household. This, again, I'm so sorry at the back, but I didn't realise we wouldn't have a bigger screen. So what this shows, that we're saying the world average is 5 to 6 tonnes of carbon dioxide, okay, per year per person. What this shows is by country, what is the average tonnage of CO2 per year per person. So on the left-hand side, the vertical axis is the CO2 tonnes, and along the bottom is the population, okay, in billions. And some interesting things, I'll show you where who we've got here. Okay, I will do, yeah. I've got the roving mic, so I might as well. So on the left here, we've got the highest 25 tonnes of carbon dioxide per year per person, Australia, shortly followed by United States of America. The United Kingdom is down here, floating between 10 and 11 tonnes of carbon dioxide per year per person. And it's interesting to see that the worst in the world, believe it or not, is Qatar, right up here. Qatar, not surprising, being an oil-rich state, but it's way up there off the scale. I've got some friends who just are moving back from Qatar, and they tell me all sorts of horrendous stories, and you can understand why they're so high, because there is such profligate waste. I think it's interesting to point out that China often gets bad press in our media, and often you hear people saying, oh, you know, building a coal-fired power station every 2 weeks, oh, you know, they're creating all sorts of problems. But if you actually consider their average sort of carbon dioxide produced, it's way down there compared to us and compared to America and Qatar and Australia, because they have such huge population, over 2 billion, isn't it? Or 2 or 3, yeah, over 2 billion. Similarly with India, India's now population over 1 billion, and it has less than 2, you know, tons of carbon dioxide per year per person. So China often gets a bad press, but actually they've got a huge poverty problem in many parts of China. They also have built, I think I'm right, I was at a lecture by Bob Watson, who was the chief scientific advisor last year to DEC. And he said that actually they've built far more wind farms than we have, or Europe. It's just you never hear about them in the press. People like to talk about the coal-fired power stations, but they're also pushing forward on the renewable energy side as well. Okay. So that's interesting to look at. It's actually about areas under that, those curves, not just about the average, you know, the how many tons per year per person. You need to consider the population. And when the Indian engineers stood up in Copenhagen a month ago and presented their national engineering response to the climate change and how they were going to tackle it in India, they said, I'm afraid the rest of us, because the rest of us were all developed countries, India was the only developing country that was presenting, and all of the rest of us were saying, this is how much we're going to reduce, we need to reduce our energy consumption by. And India was saying, well, for us, as I'm sure you've seen in the news, for us to actually achieve the levels, quality of life that we want for our people and to reduce the poverty, this is how much energy demand increase we're going to need in the next 40 years. So they were coming to it from a completely different angle as engineers to us. We were talking about reducing, they were talking about bringing this up. So you know, because the world average has got to get down to 1 ton, we've got to bring some people up, and some people have got to cut back. Okay, how are we doing for time, Heather?
We've been about 20 minutes.
Okay, about 20 minutes. Okay, so as I said, can Britain live on renewable energy? That was David Mackay's chapter where he was looking at how much we use and then how much we can supply with renewables in Britain. I'm not going to go through every chapter because it would take too long, but I'll give you a feel. We'll look at maybe cars and wind, and then cars in terms of our consumption and wind in terms of our potential renewable supply. One of the things he does, which is really helpful, is he works with figures that we all understand because we have it on our energy bills at the end of the quarter or whatever. He works with a unit which we recognise as a kilowatt hour. Okay. So that way, and if we work on our own personal consumption in kilowatt hours, it can relate to our energy bills and we can relate it to our own behaviour. So we do it to one per person to one significant figure. We choose a kilowatt hour because that's a unit we can understand from our bills. We'll look at kilowatt hours per day because that's something, it's a time scale that we can actually understand. I think there's an interesting analogy he makes, is 1 kilowatt hour per day is equivalent to have a human servant working for you all day. Okay, so 1 human servant is 1 kilowatt hour per day, apparently. We can look at, in terms of our energy supply, we can look at, okay, if we take a nuclear power station, it will provide us with thousands of watts per meter squared. If we take a wind turbine, we might get 2 watts per meter squared of land. So he looks at that, he calls it flux. Okay, so how much power can we generate given the area in Britain we've got? And then you need to think about how much area do we have in Britain. So if we're talking about putting up lots of wind farms or nuclear power stations, how much space do we actually have? And currently, what he estimated was if you take the population of Britain and you take the land area of Britain, then we, each of us in this room, could potentially have about just under the size of a football pitch each to work with. So if we were to be, you know, Felicity Kendall in The Good Life and all that, and we all had, it was a very socialist society, and we all had a bit of land each, then theoretically every person in Britain could have about the size of a football pitch to live off and to provide our power, etc. Okay, so to give you an idea of how he went through every area of our lives, cars, planes, heating, electricity, gadgets, and he estimated in ballpark figures that you can understand what kilowatt hours per day per person we are currently using in Britain. All right. So as an example, if you take a car, we can all say, well, and he actually says this is not an average use. This is someone who likes driving a car, someone who regularly drives a car, someone who isn't on their bike. In Cambridge, we use bikes a lot. You know, my husband cycles to work and I work from home, so we're not in the car that often. But if you're the sort of person who is using the car quite a bit because of your work, then he's saying this is more that person, not the average person, okay? So he would estimate, for example, that the average commuter would go 50 kilometres per day in the car, you know, about 30 to 35 miles a day. that you were, he took a figure for average car fuel consumption of 33 miles to the gallon. Well, I'm sure many of us here drive cars which are better, but he took a sort of standard family car which was advertised as an average. And that basically came to, okay, if we were to do that fuel consumption with that amount of miles per day, then we, each of us, would be using 40 kilowatt hours per day per person. Okay, so that's a building block, a red there on the bottom left. There's a little building block called car, and that's how much of energy we would use if we were to drive 30 to 50 kilometres a day, or 30 miles roughly. Okay, and then he took energy supplies and he went through all the energy supplies, and he did the same with the green blocks. Okay, so you've got the red blocks for consumption, you've got the green blocks for supply. So if you take a wind turbine, okay, and you assume a force 4 wind at all times, which, you know, is very ideal, very ideal. There are numbers based on existing wind farms which show that we can get 2 watts per meter squared from a wind turbine, okay, or wind farm. And if you assume the area that we looked at in the earlier slide, that we've got a football pitch each, okay, and you, let's say we put wind farms on 10% of the country, okay, so that's roughly about the area of Wales. Okay, so let's say we cover Wales, an area equivalent of Wales, with wind farms, okay, then we would get 20 kilowatt hours per day per person. So with that optimistic view of how many wind turbines we could have in Britain, we would only supply half of our needs for one car, okay? And that, by the way, he says, is twice as much wind power as in the whole world at the moment, okay? 50 times Denmark's existing wind energy capacity, and 7 times Germany's. Okay. Can I hold questions to the end? Because basically you have to, that 2 watts per meter squared will take into account some peak, you know, because there's a peak factor, peak loading, and you will have huge inefficiencies of wind turbines. We could come into the detail of this later, but a wind turbine might only be 30% efficient, because sometimes your wind isn't blowing, sometimes, you know, you're not using the energy and you can't store the energy. So yeah. Yeah, there are solutions, yeah. But we'll come on to them. Yeah. Okay, I'll choose one other area because I thought that was interesting. You know, I was talking about the indirect costs of our lives, and he calls this, there's a chapter called Stuff, which I like. I mean, he's a professor of physics. You don't get many Cambridge professors who talk in such good down-to-earth terms. He said, we've got a lot of stuff, and it costs energy. You know, so we can say, okay, we use our car, we fly plane, we get on a plane, we heat our houses, we put on our tellies. Those are all easy to understand. But actually, there's an awful lot of stuff there's embedded energy. When we create a can, an aluminium can, there's a huge energy cost to making that can. You have to mine the raw materials, you have to transport it to a factory, you then have to run that factory to make the alloys, to make the aluminium, then you have to punch the can out, then you have to transport it to fill it with the Coke or whatever it is you're having, and then you need to transport it from America to Britain, and there's energy cost in that. So he does this, so you'll see the red blocks and the green blocks are now much higher. They've gone off the bottom. So he started the car, and then he went the plane, and then, you know, so we're up to stuff. And that stuff, he estimates, is 48 kilowatt hours per day per person. Now, if you look at a lot of the government figures on this, because it's so difficult to work out those numbers, they just leave them off. Okay, they're not on there. And so he comes later on in the book, he comes on to a chapter where he then says, okay, these scenarios for our energy plan for 2050 or for the future, let's assume the government numbers and we'll assume the average based on those figures. And it's a lot less than his red stack, okay? It's a lot less because they find it difficult to build in all this embedded energy that we're using up, okay, on the way because of all the stuff we're using. And then, of course, we bin it. You know, for instance, the computer. You know, if we're buying one every 2 years, this amazing amount of energy goes into making a silicon chip and then putting it on a circuit board and then building it into a computer and then transporting it around the world. And then 2 years later, we maybe need to buy another one. Okay, and all that energy is lost if it sits on a mountain somewhere in China, you know, and they have to break it down again. So there's all that to be addressed as well. Okay, so when you go through all those red blocks and all those green blocks and all the chapter after chapter after chapter, you get something like this. And you've got, even with his numbers, he still says there are other things I could add on to the red stack, the consumption stack. Like, okay, road building, the red stack there, which comes to about nearly 200. The left-hand red stack, i.e. our individual British personal consumption per year, is nearly up to 200 kilowatt hours per day per person, okay, the left-hand side. And he still hasn't included all the other road building, and if we took all the energy used by industry and we spread it between us, you know, that would go on there, et cetera, et cetera. And then the green stack, which is all our renewable energies. So going back to the original question, can Britain live on renewable energies? You've got wind, you've got solar heating, you've got photovoltaic cells, you've got onshore wind farms, you've got shallow offshore wind farms, which are sort of quite near the shore. You've got deep offshore wind farms, which are way further out. You've got biofuels, you've got tidal energy, wave energy, which actually don't exist in Britain yet, but let's assume we can have huge industrial sizes of wave energy and huge sizes of tidal energy. He's put them all on there as optimistically as he can, and it still doesn't meet our current consumption. Okay? Okay, so then coming on to the scenarios he produces, as I said, there are five different scenarios. He looks at one which uses all the diverse renewable options we could have, like is indicated by the green stack. He calls that Plan D for domestic diversity. He has Plan N, which is for NIMBYism. Okay, fair enough, as long as it's not in my backyard. So in other words, people who a plan where there's not much wind. Then there's Plan L, I think, for nuclear. I don't know where he got that from. I think because the N was NIMBYism. So, but L for nuclear. So in other words, if you're actually quite pro-nuclear, and so on and so on. But even with those scenarios, he has to make quite a lot of assumptions. Okay. So on the demand side, there are ways you could say let's address the technology, like the gentleman here was saying. Wind turbines are only maybe 30% efficient, so let's address that with technology and let's try and make them 60% efficient, maybe by storing some of the electricity, you know, that isn't used because it's not peak demand or whatever. So there are ways to address it technologically, or as I've already indicated, you know, we can change our lifestyle. You know, I'm sure people here are doing that already. Or you can reduce population, which in essence, you know, China has been lambasted for years and years about their social policies on only one child per family. But when you've got 2 billion in your country, it's quite hard to actually manage the country. So they adopted that quite early on. So you could reduce your population. And there are some horrible debates. Well, for me, they're horrible. That's an emotional statement. I sometimes sit there in the tea room at Cambridge where they say, well, we should just let the populations cull themselves and it'll all work out in the end, you know, because that's one solution. You just say, okay, it'll all work out, the people will die and then the world will balance and it'll all come right in the end, you know, because actually with population growth, we're never going to do it if we allow people to continue to live, so we might as well let them die. And, you know, that's a classic Cambridge engineering, well, not classic, but it's a very sort of unemotional way of looking at it. Problem, solution. Okay, but that's what some people are starting to talk about in terms of, you know, well, we need to start bringing in some social engineering and making sure our population... Is that the battery run out? No, it's okay. Our population isn't growing beyond our control. And on the supply side, we need to talk about things like clean coal, because these numbers are not adding up. You can see the red stack and the green stack, they're just not adding up. So if we won't want a non-fossil fuel society, okay, then we're going to have to have, if there's going to be a non-fossil fuel society when the oil and gas runs out, then we're going to have to think of other ways we can actually address the energy demands that we have. For example, clean coal, for example, nuclear power, for example, importing other people's energy. And that's where we come on to, you know, the national security of supply. You know, you probably all heard about Russia putting the squeeze on Ukraine. So that's what will start happening if we're not self-sufficient. Okay. So on the right-hand, so on the left-hand side, as I said earlier, when he starts talking about his scenarios, he goes back to the national average, which is the government figures, and that national average is 125. The red stack there is 125 kilowatt hours per day per person, way lower than the almost 200 that I was talking about that he reported earlier. Okay, so even working with the 125, we're still a way off. So if you look at all the tide and the tidal, offshore wind, hydro energy, biomass, solar, we're way off. That's what we've got at the moment. We're way off meeting that with renewables at the moment. So how are we going to balance it? Okay, so, I mean, I would recommend you read all the different scenarios, but here's just one. He says, one cartoon Britain. For instance, if our energy input's on the left at 125 kilowatt hours per day per person, let's say for simplicity, you know, forget all the stuff. Let's say for simplicity, we say it's mostly transport, heating, and electricity. Okay, so we use electrical gadgets, we move ourselves around, cars and planes and stuff, and we heat our houses, our hot water and our hot air and hot water. Okay. So those are the key. If we take those three big blocks, okay, and just look at addressing those, then we can do all sorts of things. We can improve our efficiencies. For example, and this is the big government push, insulation. Okay, if we actually make ourselves more efficient, it's a simple way of addressing this the red stack problem. We reduce the red stack, and that is a big gain for a small activity. Okay, there's so much money we could spend for instance tidal energy. Okay, massive. I mean, the meeting I was at last week, a woman from the Treasury came up to me and said, "Could you come and speak to this meeting? We're currently spending £20 million a year on research in nuclear fusion. Our overall spend on energy research is £90 million. £20 million of it a year is going on nuclear fusion. Now, nuclear fusion, if we're here in 2010, nuclear fusion is back end of this century. Okay, so should we be spending? These are the sorts of decisions they're having to make. I don't envy them because they're not easy. And I've been spending 6 months looking at all the numbers, and I still think I wouldn't like to have to make those decisions. Because when are you going to have to spend the money, and how long is it going to take for each of these technologies to come on to be improved, or to tidal energy to even come on stream, or carbon capture and storage, which still needs to be proven in a decent pilot? Where do you spend your money and when, particularly in the current financial climate we've got? Okay, so small activities, big gains. That's what we're doing at the moment. And insulation, heat pumps, if we all switch, we're going to run out of gas. It's going to happen. So we might as well switch to heat pumps, electric, and then we don't lose all the energy upstream from that. Perhaps we could use more wood. We've got a wood burner at home. We never buy wood because we manage to scavenge it from skips and, from forests and, so basically you move to wood, you actually don't have so much loss when you're using wood. Biofuels and electric vehicles. Now, that's a biggie. But our plan, which I'll come on to talk to you about in a minute, the IMEC-E's plan, my husband works in the automotive industry. He works on the end where emissions control. So their company's instrumentation will be measuring hydrocarbons in exhaust, nitrogen oxide, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, so that automotive companies can actually make engines that are cleaner. And I said to him back in February, the company's not going to be there in 2050. And he said, oh, poppycock, poppycock. But actually, by the end of the report, everybody in the project team had a consensus that there will be no internal combustion engines in cars by 2050. We have to go electric. And I saw this change in my husband, you know. Basically, the company will not be there, you know. And it's hard for us to imagine, but we had these conservative, with a small C, engineers on this project team all agreeing that our cars will be electric. So, you know, we can debate that, but the numbers will not add up if we don't do it. Okay, so I've talked a lot about this future climate project already, but I was saying to some of the Heather and colleagues earlier that I came back from Copenhagen really inspired. So the idea of the Future Climate Project was to gather together engineering associations from around the world who had addressed their country's national targets for 2050 based on the Kyoto protocols, and to get them to work on their national plans for a year. So it was launched, Future Climate was launched in 2008, and then we gathered together in early September this year to present our engineering plans to each other. And we had diplomats there, so we had three, we started off with 12 countries and 13 engineering associations, and that included America. The biggest engineering association in America is the American Society of Mechanical Engineers. That was America, India, the Institute of Engineers in India, Japan, and then mostly European countries, so other than those three. So there were all the Scandinavian ones there. Germany was there, and the UK was there. Okay, and I've probably forgotten one or two. But basically, a huge international gathering of engineers, unprecedented, actually, to talk about climate change and the technological response to the climate challenge. And when I put my hand up at the IMEC-E, because as Heather said, all of this for me has been voluntary, as a fellow, they were looking for someone to take this by its scruff of the neck and actually address it. I put my hand up because it's something I care about. You know, I want to be able to say to my children, I did my best to actually help this problem, to work on this problem. I realised very early on that actually that there wasn't a plan. We didn't have, back in April, there was nothing published. The first Committee on Climate Change had published up to 2022, but there was not an official document from government which said, how are we going to do it by 2050? And yet the government had 80% reduction targets of greenhouse gases by 2050. And from the start of us getting together the project team in March to the production of the report in August, suddenly there was this plethora. Everybody's been working on it this year. And if I've taken that away, I'm quite encouraged by what I've seen happening. And I hope I can pass that on to you, that there is a lot of activity now. There is a greatly increased political will to actually increase this. Now, of course, to address this problem, of course, we're not there yet. But I've seen huge activity just in that 6 months. And so it came to the, so we had to produce this and present it in early September. And because it was a definitive solution, it was one scenario. But my job was to pull together our engineers from across the institution and build a consensus plan. So instead of lots of scenarios, we needed to have one consensus plan. Now, we're talking, just to put a bit of background on that for you. You've got engineers who are working in the nuclear industry. They're members of and fellows of the Institution of Mechanical Engineers. We've got engineers working in the renewable energy industry. So we've got people, my job was to bring these people together and to grow a consensus. And I thought in April, we're never going to do it. You know, we had to produce this report by August and then present it in September. I thought we're never going to do it. But I was amazed that actually we did get consensus. And it's because those numbers are so challenging. Let me show you some of the people that we had on board. Okay, so these were our goals, okay, set by the Future Climate Project. So the preparation of a national plan to meet the overall target of achieving a less than 2 degree rise in average global temperatures, and to address the UK's commitment to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by 2050. And again, I'm a realist, I'm an engineer, okay, so I'm numbers mad. But I did come away from the Future Climate Conference in September hugely proud, maybe, of the UK government because we are leading the way. We presented alongside all these other countries, and there were very few of them that had such ambitious targets as that. And quite often, like I was saying earlier on to some of Heather and her colleagues, that America, the ASME engineers stood up and said, well, of course, what we need in the future is we need a policy framework to make sure we can measure the energy efficiency of homes. And I thought, wow, we did that with HIPS a couple of years ago, you know. I mean, and quite often when countries, engineers were standing up and saying, we need our governments to have a policy on local food, sourcing food locally. And, you know, as you're probably aware, this was announced earlier this summer. I'm not a Labour voter, so I'm not here to be pro-Labour, but I just came away encouraged that actually compared to a lot of the countries that were there, and those are countries that are going to be interested in this subject because they were turning up at the conference, we were actually ahead of the game. And we were seen to be ahead of the game by the other organisations there. And as I said, you know, there were diplomats. We had three ambassadors there, the ambassador to Copenhagen from Japan, the ambassador for Norway, I think it was, and I think one other Scandinavian country turned up, and then diplomats from another four or five countries. So it had a pseudo-political aim. We also had negotiators who were actually going to be negotiating in December, COP15 negotiators, and people from the United Nations, FCCCC, I think they call it, the big organisation that is actually helping with the negotiation process in December. But they're expecting to have 15,000 people in Copenhagen in December. And the advice to us, they gave to us, these negotiators, was don't wait till December, do it now. Because there's going to be such a fuss in Copenhagen, there's going to be such a busy hive of activity that your voice might be lost. Do it now when you get back home to your countries. Start lobbying, which is what I know a lot of you are doing anyway. So that was the first point. And we had to identify what engineering solutions we were going to come up with to meet those goals. Okay, so the project team. I've talked about David already. We had Brian Cox, who, and again, I stress the importance of being independent here. David Mackay himself was independent. You don't want people who work for an energy company trying to come up with this plan. You might have them on board, but you might not necessarily be a good idea to have them leading it, something like that. So there's quite a few independent folk here. Three professors from Cambridge University, David himself, Professor of Energy, Cambridge University Engineering Department, who's also a Fellow of the Institution of Mechanical Engineers. Peter Guthrie is Professor of Sustainable Development, Cambridge University Engineering Department, a Fellow of the Institution of Civil Engineers. Now, for some of you who are engineers, you will understand this when I say, hey, IMECE is working with the ICE, because there's actually quite a bit of politics and history in the UK with engineering associations. And this is another huge, like I was saying about global communication, the engineering institutions are coming alongside one another because it is such a big issue. And that's going to happen across the world, I think. And so on. So Tim Jackson, he's in our IMECE's Power Industries group. So basically he has access to the nuclear expertise. Michael Reed, another fellow of the IMECE, who is in our Energy, Environment and Sustainability group. So he has access to all the renewable energy folk. Malcolm Vandenberg, unfortunately, did you see the news where the wave energy machine tipped up off Suffolk recently? Unfortunately, that was Malcolm's job, so I haven't heard from him since then because there's been all sorts of problems with trialling the wave energy machine, Trident Energy. Tim Hans was in transport, in the automotive industry, and then various folk, Colin Brown, Tim Fox, Brian Robinson, Lara Mallett, who are responsible for energy and environment issues at headquarters of IMECE. So a big team of people to grow consensus with, and plenty of other people outside of that we had to check for checking numbers, so because the numbers that we had to come up with were often not there. You know, so what is our gigawatt capacity for coal per year in the UK? You know, what if we're going to reduce that by 2050, what will be our gigawatt capacity in 2050? So we gathered together, we had meetings, we had workshops, we had brainstorm sessions, we wrote the report, we had it validate the numbers validated by external experts who were not part of the IMEC-E. We peer-reviewed that report around and around and around and around until we finally published it in August, ready for the conference. You can now find it online, and I've sent it to Heather and Co. They will have a link, so, and it's currently being reprinted, but we'd rather you looked at it online for obvious reasons. And it's freely downloadable. As is, I should have mentioned, I'm not here. He didn't ask me to promote his book, by the way. I just am, because it's the seminal book on this subject, really. You can get this free online as well, okay, so you don't have to buy the book. Okay, and as I said before, we know this is a work in progress. Our consensus plan is a work in progress because it's evolving the whole time. So where are we at time-wise? Okay, well, let me give you the overall plan. So looking at all those numbers, as I said, looking at our energy mix, our energy supply now, what will our energy supply need to be in 2050? Okay, that's what this graph is showing. On the left-hand side, there's a table which has got all the numbers for and the left-hand column is 2006, and we've got hydropower, we've got every energy supply that you can think of, hydropower, geothermal, biomass, wind, solar heat, waste, wave and tidal, photovoltaic, nuclear, coal and gas, okay? And those are mirrored by a colour in the graph, okay? And the milestones we were given as part of the Future Climate Project were starting at 2006, that's your benchmark. What will we aim to have by 2015, 2030, and then finally by 2050? That's a big ask, because it's quite hard to actually, you know, the Committee on Climate Change has worked up until 2022, you know, actually deciding how long it's going to take to knock the technology carbon capture and storage on the head is a really difficult ask, you know. So what milestones you choose in between is in itself quite hard to define. So this is what we came up with. And this looks like our energy demand is increasing, but actually, this is where it gets confusing. Okay, our primary energy supply is our overall amount of energy embedded in the fuel that we might use, okay? And then there are losses, like I mentioned earlier, there are losses in the system. So when you take oil and you shove it into, or you take coal and you shove it into your coal-fired power station, you know, you've seen the cooling towers and the big white water vapour that goes out the top. A lot of it is lost in heat. And you end up with about a 40% efficient process. Similarly, an interesting statistic, if you put a litre of fuel in your car, okay, most of that energy will go out the exhaust in heat. Okay, and again, you only get about 30 or 40% because most of it will be wasted through the exhaust in heat. So it's very inefficient to put a litre of fuel and basically just explode it, and you'll get some of that out, but the rest of it will be lost. Similarly, when you put a litre of fuel in your car, it will take around about a litre and a half to get it to that point where you put it in your car. So every litre of fuel that you put in your car is actually you're using 2.5 litres, if you see what I mean, because you've got to prospect for the oil and gas, you've got to find the reservoir, you've got to drill, you've got to put a platform on there. Now, you know, I used to work for BP, so I used to work offshore and see all this massive amounts of money being spent and massive amounts of energy being used. You've got to then suck it up. You've got to pump it to shore with huge pipelines. You've got to refine it. You've got to send it off down along the roads in big, you know, oil tankers. And eventually, it'll get to your petrol station. So an awful lot of that energy is used to actually give you the litre of fuel. And then when you put it in the car, you lose an awful lot in the heat out the end. That wouldn't happen with electric. So there's waste, okay? But when you go to electric cars, for example, so that looks like the overall capacity is going up, but actually it's transferring to electrical supply, all right? So the overall energy the overall energy supply, we are suggesting in our plan, has to go down by 50%. So all of us, you and I, need to reduce our energy consumption by 50% for this plan to work. And this is an incredibly conservative, with a small c, plan. This is a consensus plan with a bunch of conservative engineers who work from a cross-section of renewable and nuclear industries and da-da-da-da. We are saying that for this to work, we need to reduce our energy consumption by 50%. Okay? So the grey, okay, is the gas. So as we've all heard, gas is diminishing. So there's a lot of gas in 2006 on the left, over 50%, way down 10% on the right by 2050. The black is coal. Coal, again, starting, you know, all over 20 gigawatts capacity there, again, reducing almost to 10% of what it was in 2006. In contrast, and then the pink, you've got nuclear. I mean, our view was, even reducing our energy consumption by 50%, it's going to be impossible to provide that amount of that energy, even if we're reducing it by 50%, without using nuclear. We'd have to reduce it by even more if we wanted to get rid of nuclear completely. I thought I was going to have real trouble getting the renewable people and the nuclear people to agree, because for obvious reasons, I thought, well, the nuclear are going to want to say, yeah, we need more nuclear power stations, and the renewable are going to say, yeah, we need more wind farms. But actually, the British Wind Energy Association, who we asked as an external expert, said, oh, no, you've got too many wind farms in your plan, you need more nuclear. And the nuclear people said to us, oh, no, that's far too much nuclear, you'll have to have more wind farms. Because they realised this is such a big challenge to ramp up by 2050 so rapidly. So I was amazed that we got consensus, but it was because they know that we've got a big challenge ahead of us to get up this quickly to meet even this plan. So in contrast, so the pink is nuclear, yellow you've got photovoltaic, blue you've got water, wave and tidal. And, you know, as many of you know, I'm sure, Britain is always said to be well set for wave and tidal compared to other countries in the world, and we are. But we're still looking at a very small amount, even though Britain has got bigger waves. I think we've got, coming in on the west coast of Scotland, we've got waves as big as Hawaii, and we've got a fantastic tidal opportunity in the North Sea, because the Atlantic sweeps in around the top of Scotland and into the North Sea, and then it sweeps out again. So, and that's a very predictable energy supply, because it's happening on a regular basis, and it would be very nice to harness that. Okay, but even so, even if you harness that, you're still only talking a small amount. But it's way, if you look at 2006, there's none. So even that, we're ramping the technology up quite drastically. And so on and so on. So, I mean, I can take more detailed questions on that. But you can see the challenge is huge. But what I said earlier over dinner was, I was quite inspired, because when all these engineers came together from all over the world, from different directions, and presented their national energy plans to each other, there was a real consensus that the technology was feasible, that we do have the technology. It sounds like Star Trek, isn't it? We have the whatever it is to go where no man has gone before. But we do have the technology. What we need is the political will and the investment. That's what we need. So as engineers, we can do it, but we need the political will. And I have seen this last 6 months, the political will is escalating exponentially. You know, it's really rapidly improved this year. Just, I think an important point for our plan anyway, taking all the renewable energies together, we still couldn't see that they would be more than 40%. I know Zero Carbon Britain talks about, I think is it wind, it talks about something like just wind, it talks about 50 to 60% just wind. But the British Wind Energy Association and our engineers anyway just couldn't see how you could possibly get that much energy just from wind without sort of completely covering Britain, I suppose. So I think I'll just finish off with the imperatives from our point of view. I mean, there are other things I could tell you about the detail of, you know, what we need to do about transport, what we need to do about heating, etc. But the key points that we presented in Copenhagen, and, you know, my next job is to write to Lord Stern. I mean, we've got actions to lobby as the Institution of Mechanical Engineers now. We're moving into the lobbying arena like many of yourselves, but only at a, I suppose, an organisational level. Imperatives, we, as far as we saw, it was, as I said, you know, a fifth, each of us has to, and the country as a whole, will have, for this plan to work, we'll have to reduce by 50% our energy demand. Okay, so a reduction in primary energy supply of 48% or 50%, based on a major commitment to carbon capture. Okay, and so we will need to make our power stations much more efficient. We will need CHP, we will need combined heat and power for our power stations as well. Our energy supplies must reduce to zero low carbon sources to achieve an 89% reduction. Now that's engineers talking, because we know that if we aim for 80, we won't hit it. In the same way as that if we wanted to build Wembley in time, we didn't build it. So you always build in some risk management. So we're pretty, like I said right at the beginning, we're essentially almost aiming for a zero carbon society here, really. So we're saying let's aim for more, and then if we're lucky, we might get 80% by 2050. And it's complex. And there are all sorts of other things I haven't mentioned, which people often think engineers don't think about the social side, but actually five of our training criteria are non-technical. So when graduate in engineering, then we are then measured on five non-technical training criteria, which include people management, financial management, marketing, legal requirements. So we need a holistic view. We're used to dealing with holistic views. And there are all sorts of other issues like security of supply. How are you going to change people's behaviour? It's all very well having the technology, but people have got to want to change. So, some conclusions. It is complex. I mean, I've only tickled some of the numbers tonight. It's complex. It is a challenge. We're seeing it as the third industrial revolution, that it is as big as that. And we're going to need a lot of engineers to and a lot of highly trained people to actually make it work. And we're up for it. That's a challenge to you, really. I put this background up because a couple of years ago when I first started getting into this, I got into it because I phoned up at my local council and I said, all those bottles at Tesco's bottle bank, where does it end up? I spent 3 hours on the phone. I don't know if you've ever done that. I'm sure you have because you're all lobbying people. I'm not a lobbyer, I'm an engineer. But they didn't know. And even after 3 hours, they still didn't know. So they sent me to the person who actually collects all the bottles. Eventually, after 3 hours, they said, oh, you better phone them because they are the ones who collect it. And he said, well, I don't know. I better go and find out. And it turned out that they were going to container ports, they were being put in containers, and they were going to China. And when they went to China, nobody knew what happened to them. But now they do, because I phoned up. And I couldn't believe it, but I had been the only person ever to phone up the council and ask what happened to our plastic bottles. So it's one person, going back to what we were saying at the beginning of the evening, one person can make a difference. And I put this one up for my, you probably can't see it, but this is really from my president of Institution of Mechanical Engineers. He said, Alison, we need more women in the institution. So here's my waste mountain of women. It's a waste mountain of Barbie dolls. Okay. So that's really for him. How he thinks I can do that job, I don't know. Manufacture a load of women at the Institute of Mechanical Engineers. If you know any women who like physics, you know, do encourage them to go into engineering because we need them. So I think, I'm happy to answer questions, but I think we're going to have a break for refreshments and come back for questions afterwards, yeah?